We'll find poetry in middle-class America on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we'll examine Phil Tabaco's poetic view of regular life. Then check out the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor on Scribble.
Phil, it's nice to have you here today to talk to us a little bit about poetry. I'm going to begin with a couple of questions that we've been asking every poet we've had on this year, particularly given the turmoil of this past year. Start with the big one. Does the poet, when he or she sits down to write, have any obligations? And I'm thinking of Jane Hirschfield, who, when the scientists got together for their big protest over climate change across the country, she called the head of the organizing committee and said, "You've got to include a poet in every one of these sessions. And poets need to start standing up and changing the way people think."
Well, I think it's a good thing when poets choose to take those responsibilities, but I don't believe that it's specifically the responsibility of poets to change anything.
So you can do anything you want?
Well, yes.
What about Annie Dillard, who said a poem can do anything, a poet can do anything he wants except tell the truth, except lie?
Well, I think it was Jean Cocteau said interesting statements. A poet is a liar who always tells the truth.
Well, so W.H. Auden said poetry makes nothing happen.
Yes, he did. And so, he proved it.
So there's no definite answer to my question.
Well,
right?
I can't really answer. And I think there are personal obligations, and then probably there are poetic.
What do you mean by personal obligations?
Well, I mean that any human or any citizen might have, but I don't know that there's some distinct responsibility for political or social happenings or events that a poet has by being a poet.
Yeah, well, it's
it's a cop out.
No, but to me, poetry is one of those private actions. It's something you do. You don't make up a poem in public. You generally do it when you're alone. You're alone with your thoughts and paper and pen or computer or something, and you focus on what's in your mind. And what's in your mind depends on what kind of life you're leading. What's intensely personal? What really is roiling you at the moment? It can be public life, but quite often it's private life.
But you do have a reader, or you hope you have a reader or two, right?
Well, I wonder sometimes. I wonder, there are things that people write and never see the light of day. They write for some reason to express themselves, to put down, almost to try to understand what they're thinking. Harry Truman did that all the time. He wrote these letters to vent, and his assistant would read the letters and throw them away. Hmm. And the one time his assistant was gone is when the famous letter about his daughter Margaret Truman became public. Otherwise, that never would have happened. And some people write just to write. Why do you write?
Well, there certainly is a really strong component of writing because I need to write to try to understand my experience. So that's a personal thing. But yes, I do hope also for a reader. So that you hope that somehow whatever struggle, maybe that's too strong a word, but whatever you go through to create a poem will have resonance with at least a few other people, and hopefully
or even just one other. But
at least one other.
Even if you say I'm just doing this for myself, I think I agree with Phil and disagree with you, Don.
What? How dare you? How dare you?
Well, let me quote one other. I just read Czesław Miłosz, who said, what poem does not change a nation or a person? Right?
Yeah, well, that's, I guess, in Russia is one of those countries where poets actually are listened to,
right.
or so they say.
Well, poets are listened to here, too.
Yes, by some, true.
Well, and that leads to question number two, and then we'll get down to your poetry. Why, when children love poetry almost universally, and most of the books they read are books of poetry, and they love to have poetry read to them, why, by the time they graduate from high school, are they afraid of poetry or hate poetry, or I just not into poetry?
Now, that's absolutely true, and you're right. I mean, you're right in all respects.
Are we
children love poetry. Well, you know, teachers keep talking about this and blaming themselves or trying to blame someone or understand why that's true. And I certainly don't have an answer for it. You know, it's just part of it is just the change in technology, isn't it? I mean, possibly that people are now just responding to other forms of
I think people have always
creative forms, I guess.
My mother taught English, and I think too she had trouble getting through to high school teachers students who didn't like poetry.
Right.
Well, don't you think it's because when you're teaching, you're talking about Bosque Dells and so on, and
yeah,
what
some
the
of
heck
that.
Does that mean? It doesn't relate to.
So we're choosing the wrong material as poems.
I really do. I think there are poems out there that. You'd have kids doing poetry all their lives if you would choose rather carefully. Not always.
Well, limericks, yeah.
Not always from the canon.
I agree with Don on this one.
Of course.
I think we choose the wrong. Yeah, and some. And can I give an example from
sure,
my life?
Yeah.
I remember, you know, reading and some at some point. I remember being very annoyed at we read a Wordsworth Daffodils poem, which is not fair to Wordsworth,
right.
but and I said, "What do I?" You know, and then I read. T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Man when I was in junior high school, and it had a profound effect on me. That's all I can say, and I never forgot. And it was the cadences of it, but it also was the despair that,
right.
you know, adolescents feel.
Right.
But it really connected, and it didn't seem to be a poem that I would have thought that would have, but I really got it.
Yeah.
That's the first time I remember that.
Those teenage poems of Phyllis McGinley, I can't think of a high school girl reading those poems would not react to it with fervor, with the thought that there I am, 13, 14, 15,
yeah.
16, she nails me at every age. And why not put those poems in?
Well, you know, there are poetry readers. I mean, there are a lot of, and it seems to be more people who want to write poetry than who want to read it. But
you know, Francine Prose, I just read her book on teaching poetry, and she said when she got into her first creative writing classes, MFA classes, she was astounded by how few of her creative writing students were readers.
Yeah, that's easy.
And didn't care to but read. And she said, "What in the world?"
It's hard to imagine.
They want to write, but they have no interest in reading. And it seems to me reading, and for Francine Prose too, reading is the hard.
You know,
if you want to learn how to write, read.
Right.
And reading is as creative as writing.
Yes.
We better get to one of Phil's poems.
Yeah. Let's quickly read Elegy for me, will you?
Oops,
it's on page 55, I think, something like that.
Is that the death of poetry? I think it is.
Page 55.
It is. Actually, they've been predicting the death of poetry for a long time, so. This is my version of it, I guess. Elegy. The poem is dead. The words give up the ghost. The verbs crawl back into their tenses and practice perishing. The nouns flee to the suburbs in does and Subaru wagons. When the last adjective strangles itself with the wires of an upright piano, the poet pens his epitaph on the margins of a terminal contraction. But the church bells and cash registers resurrect themselves and resume their ringings, sweetnesses to the ears unrelated to the conjunctions of sound and sense within little chapels called syntax and stanza. All the gods are glad to return to the diversions of their familial feuds beyond the futile gestures of language. And the speechless angels, shimmying their gossamer wings, strum those golden harps for another round of celestial singing.
How about that's good. Yes. Well, I was taught in when I was in college, several of my college teachers, you know, said you're going into English, you're essentially going to be teaching history because Atomic Age is not hospitable to poetry. And yeah. Once the last few great novelists, you know, Steinbeck and Hemingway and those die, there's going to be nothing else. Well, the poetry is more alive and well.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And more widely written today than ever before.
But I like some things.
If not yeah. widely read.
Yeah. Well, it's even read.
Even read. Not... You know, someone mentioned, I think maybe it's true, there's always been a readership for, you know, I hate the word, use that word, but serious poetry.
Right.
And it's always not that different in size or something like that.
Right.
In time. That... And it's still there.
Right.
Yeah.
I love within little chapels called syntax and stanza.
One of the things that intrigued me about your poetry is you're swiping phrases from other poets and turning them inside out. Like Phil, you have a poem on Phil Levine. He wrote a book called What Is Work?
Yeah,
and you play on that and sort of make fun of him. And then you know, your poem on Keats and your poem on Whitman. Using phrases from them and kind of turning the tables on them. Is that something you really enjoy doing, apparently?
I guess I do. You know, I wrote a lot of these poems while I was being a graduate student.
Okay.
And so that's no doubt had a lot to do with it.
Read Splenetic to us on page 42.
That's the Philip Levine or Phil
Levine.
Yeah,
that is.
Okay. Who is, I guess your readers know, you know, he just died recently.
Just died
last year, yeah. A well-known poet. Okay. Splenetic. You know, I'm getting really tired of reading Phil Levine's poems about his working class sufferings. According to the book blurbs, this man was teaching in the sun of a California college by the time he was 30. At that age, I was still hauling leather coats out of a wooden vat of petroleum cleaning fluid. Ah, forget it. No man's made heroic by his incompetence. Me? I was where I was, dripping oil onto a factory floor, bulldog boss barking at my heels, because I was born without a brain. Which, come to think of it, is pretty much what he says about himself, too. Only, I'm supposed to bemoan his ineptitude, since he was a budding genius all the while, and I'm just another guy named Phil. Well, you can have it, pal, name-sharer, subject thief. My size 12 clodhoppers are dropping onto the page beside your own winged shoes. We don't know what work is.
So much for that. That's good. That's
Thank
good.
You.
If I had to pick one line from all the poems, it's probably a line you wouldn't even think I would pick, but it's the line of the poem that begins, "This is the upper bunk of history."
Oh, yeah.
And my thinking was at the end of that, why would you need the rest of the poem? You know,
others have said that about my poem.
No, that is. Well, Henry James said he, you know, wrote everything but the first chapter for people too dumb to get it at the end of the first chapter. But I was reminded Bill Knott, who's a poet that has fallen between the cracks, but he died in December.
Yeah, interesting poem.
And he has a poem called History, which is a one line poem. It's hope ... goose steps.
Wow.
And the history, the upper bunk of history is to me that kind of powerful image.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Let me push on. I want to hear another poem. How about on page 48, how Alphonse sees it?
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's actually in a form, right?
That's what?
This is a formal poem.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the form, I think, got control of the poem, but sprawled on the curb of my favorite street, watching this bread truck rust in peace, I feel fortunate for having been able to fall, thankful for being born after the bomb built the proliferation of patience as consolation for a world again gone flat. In England, what we call a dump's a flat. I say call a bomb and a street a street. Tinkering for orders, Tom Edison practiced patience. Perhaps this policy produced his peace of mind. Me? I try to stay clear of all bombs because I've heard about that first fateful fall. Does it matter, really, whether we stand or fall? I mean, after our lives have already fallen flat. We can turn to God, learn to wire a bomb, or move to Memphis to dig Beale Street and feel blue and still fail to find peace. Experience, after all, fits us only for patience, I think or once thought. And though patience isn't a theological tenet of the fall, I do suspect that some disturbers of the peace think the prelapsarian's a garden gone flat, an unbroken plain, a dead-end street. Say a cop sees a terrorist with a bomb, in his dream, I mean, and screams, "Snuff that bomb!" But his wife, the model, after all, of patience, shakes him gently. She, too, fears the street, where in her own dream she's seen her man fall, lifeless and breathless, a lump below a flat. A theosophist now, she seeks the solace of peace. Like that Bobby's wife, I've paid for my peace, and like Ripper, I've learned to love the bomb. Just as this truck accepts that its tires are flat, I've resigned myself in the name of patience to the exact proportions of my own private fall. And, so inclined, I survey the deserted street. For I now know both peace and the patience of passing time before the bombs begin to fall, and when it's best to lie flat on a fallen street.
There's a structured poem.
Right.
Yeah. That's good. I wish we...
The troll is the get out of control. When you're trying, you got to watch out for that. Yeah.
Oh, dear. Phil Tabaco, we really appreciate your being here today. And I wish we had an hour to read your poems because they are really, really impressive. And the book is called The Mechanics of Structure.
Submission.
What?
Submission.
Submission, pardon. The Mechanics of Submission. Yeah, one way or another, look for Phil Tabakow, Tabakow. Thanks again, Phil. And from there, we move to another distinguished gentleman, Garrison Keillor. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Oh, we want to dive into the book bag, but we'd like to find there another poem by Phil Tabaco. Phil, your book, which was published several years ago and still is in print, you have other manuscripts, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Give us, before we conclude today, give us an example of some of the poems that have yet to be published.
Okay, should I read this?
Yes,
okay.
Please.
I'm going to read a poem that I think is the title poem of my so far unpublished manuscript. The title of the poem is When the Bear Dances. Skirted and muzzled, his terrible claws clipped, he turns on a point in time. And Pablo twists the rope. Juan strikes the strings. Tina laughs. She flashes a gold tooth and twirls. The men drink up her long brown legs. They roll cigarettes and pass the jug. They stomp their feet and shout. Ragged urchins run abreast of the beast. They poke him with wands of willow. They blind him with handfuls of dust. But when the bear dances, everybody dances. By the grace of God and the devil's goad they dance. They dance and they dance and they dance. Widows lift their skirts and pound the dry, packed earth. The butcher abandons his block. The baker brings his dough. Father Gregory swings his censer and eyes the eager altar boys. The wrestler bears his weights. The cuckold comes with his wife. And they dance and they dance and they dance. By the grace of God and the devil's goad they dance. When the bear dances, everybody dances. And Pablo twists the rope.
Wow. That can be taken several ways. The bear is the Russian bear. That's very good.
Thank you.
What do you think?
I like it. Yeah, in his poem about Keats, he imagines Keats living longer than he did and ending up becoming a tax collector or a tax stamp salesman. you never know what's going to happen, and that could, and it does happen to people. But I see Phil has not become a tax collector.
Not yet.
he remains a good poet. One of the things we haven't talked about is where can we get copies of your...
It's available on Amazon and other online sites, and it's actually still from the publisher, which is DC Books of Montreal.
Okay.
You'll see.
But Amazon is where most people get their books.
Yeah, that's
anyway.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you have a Canadian publisher. Is that unusual?
Probably. I have Canadian connections. I used to teach Canadian literature and be a member of a Canadian Studies Council, and I had a brother who was a Canadian citizen, so I had connections. That helped.
Well, Canada generally is more open to all the arts. Isn't that the case?
Yes. I'm not sure all Canadians would agree, but it's possibly true, I think. There's more support, I think, public support.
Well, in your blurb, you say that you have done papers on the difference between Canadian and American landscape poetry.
I did do a paper, yeah.
Is a poem determined partly by where it takes place? I mean, what's the difference between Canadian
well,
and...
Well, the idea was that Canadians have a different attitude toward, toward the land or toward their place in the land. There's been, I mean, in Canada, it's a kind of a big issue about what they call it, the garrison mentality, that Canadians never felt exactly at home, or, you know, Americans talk about the frontier spirit and pushing westward, that there was always a fear of the land itself, which you can imagine is true. I mean, Canada is a very northern and very difficult place to live, I think. I mean, it was for settlers, certainly.
Yeah, it's but that is interesting that we have an American poet talking about recognizably American things, but you have a Canadian publisher. I would say whatever works.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much again, Phil. It's been a pleasure hearing your poems, and it's The Mechanics of Submission. I've got the title right now. And with that, Roll Tweet and I will fade away. We'll be back next week for another session of Scribble.